Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Hebrew, the Project Zion series that reduces Old Testament bitterness through explanation, exploration, and experiencing the text. Our guides through the Old Testament, or Hebrew scriptures, are Tony and Charmaine Shabala-Smith, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. In today's episode, which we've sort of titled The Davidic Monarchy, David, Bathsheba, and the Me Too Movement, our episode looks at the Davidic monarchy specifically, David, Nathan, and of course, Bathsheba. So we're in 2 Samuel. For those of you who are wanting to reread stretches of the Old Testament, and I have to tell you, 2 Samuel, while about David, has a lot of stuff happening in there, much of it to women, and none of it good. So just be prepared when you read it. So let's start in with this particular text, Tony and Charmaine. What do we need to know?
So first of all, we're in the books of Samuel and actually Kings too. And in our English Bibles, these are divided into two books, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. That's an old tradition that goes back to the Septuagint, which was the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. The Septuagint translators took these books of the Hebrew Bible when they were putting them into Greek and divided them in two. And except in Jewish circles, pretty much ever since then, those books have been divided. In a Hebrew Bible, it's Samuel and Kings. So those are the books that we're in. And Samuel and Kings together tell the story of the rise and fall of an Israelite monarchy. So you start off in Samuel. It's the end of the period of the judges, when the people of Israel are really this kind of loose confederation of tribes. And occasionally, when dire need emerges, Yahweh raises up a judge. And we talked about judges in our last podcast. Judges, the Hebrew word shofet, a judge, was not so much a judicial figure, though they could do that. A judge is more like a charismatic tribal military leader. And so that whole episode in their story kind of spirals out of control by the time you get to the end of the book of Judges. And so in the book, in the start of Samuel, the people of Israel start wondering about and asking for a king. And so what you have in Samuel and Kings then is a monarchy emerges. The monarchy passes after one king, it passes to David. And then David and his son Solomon are the monarchy at its height. And then the rest of the story in the Hebrew Bible going through the book of Kings is kind of a tragedy, almost a Greek tragedy, really, as the monarchy divides into two parts at the death of Solomon, a northern one, Israel, a southern one, Judah. And then eventually the northern one is destroyed by the Assyrians. And then by the time you get to the end of the book of Kings, the Judean monarchy, the Davidic monarchy, is ending in Babylonian exile. So it's kind of a wild ride through those two books. Going up, going down is pretty much how it happens here. So that's the storyline of the books that we're in. And let's go to some contextual features about this monarchy. So you might ask the question, so how did this loose collection of tribes, Israelite tribes, who shared some ancestors like Abraham and Sarai, and shared a language, Hebrew, and shared some founding sacred stories and rituals like the Passover and the Exodus, how did they come to create a monarchy sometime, late in the 11th century BCE? The traditional date for Saul becoming king is 1020 BCE. So how did that happen? And the critical historian will give you a different answer from what the texts might give.
Oh, well, this will be good.
Yeah. So the historian's answer would be something like this. So as Israel is emerging in Canaan, something major is happening along the seacoast. A group of sea peoples who trace themselves back to the Aegean Sea, these people called the Philistines, are landing on the coast and setting up settlements. And so they are a superior military and political power. They're really well organized. They have superior
weapons.
Yeah, superior strategy. Weaponry, strategy. They know how to fight well. And then you have these sheep herder people learning the ropes in Canaan, who have bronze weapons, not iron weapons, and who don't know what they're doing, actually. And so one historically plausible answer for why a monarchy emerges is that as those Philistines settle the coast and begin moving inland and start running into Israelite tribes, that the Israelites realize that they can't, that what's been working for them isn't working anymore, right? So they need to have some kind of centralized authority, some kind of centralized way of creating an army that can withstand the Philistines. The other thing, too, is you have to remember Canaan is this little tiny neck of land that's sort of like the freeway between empires, Egypt to the south, and then Aram or Syria, and then Assyria and Babylon to the north. And everybody wants this little strategic piece of land. So tribes are just not going to be able to do it. So you have to have some kind of centralized authority. And a king seems like a good idea.
And everybody else has one.
Exactly.
So, heck yeah.
We ought to have one too.
So there are plausible, historical, social, cultural, and economic reasons why a monarchy would develop. Now, the authors and editors of Samuel and Kings, and I'm using the words authors and editors because what we have here in Samuel and Kings are like community writing projects, right? These books are created out of many different sources. Lots of hands have been involved in them. The authors and editors of Samuel and Kings are finishing their editorial work on these books in the Babylonian exile. When they're trying to answer the question, how in the heck did we lose it all? So if the monarchy is beginning like around 1020 BCE, and these books are coming together in the form we're reading them in translation, sometime after 587 BCE, almost 500 years going on there, mm-hmm. The people in exile are trying to think, what did we do to deserve this? How did we get here? How did we lose everything? How did we lose this monarchy? How did we lose our homeland? Right? They're asking theodicy questions. Where is God? Why did this happen to us? One answer, not the only answer, but one answer was the Deuteronomists' answer. The Deuteronomists, another school of thought in ancient Israel, their answer was because we were disobedient and we had a monarch and we sinned and we followed other gods. It's our fault we're here.
We didn't trust.
So that's not a happy answer.
No, it's not a happy answer. It's one of the answers. It's a theological interpretation of why they're in exile, and it's sort of overlaid throughout Samuel and Kings.
Right. So I need to insert a question here because we have this through the whole situation, the Deuteronomist perspective. We sinned, we were disobedient, bad things happened to us because that's what happens when you're disobedient to God. That's a narrative that's still out there.
Oh, yes.
We hear it all the time.
Yeah. After every natural disaster, you hear, well, this is God's punishment because whatever the city was that experienced the disaster, they must be sinful and this must be God's punishment of them for that.
So that's a popular reason that we hear. What are the other perspectives on that?
Right, it's popular because people don't read the Bible very well. That's one reason it's popular. It's also popular because it's simplistic. And the people with whom it's popular never say it about themselves. Right? It's always an explanation of others, right?
Those people had this thing happen to them because, unlike us,
right.
They did something wrong, or they think something wrong, or they're for something in society that's obviously God is against.
So, and I said they don't read the Bible well. They don't, because here's the deal. The Hebrew Bible has other explanations.
Okay.
And the Hebrew Bible has texts that push back on the Deuteronomist explanation for things. For example, the book of Ezekiel, chapter 18, Ezekiel basically says, you know, that idea we've had for like 1,000 years that if you sin, it'll be put on the generations after you. Ezekiel says, God says, stop saying that. That's dumb. You're responsible for your own stuff.
That might be a bit of a paraphrase.
As I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically.
I like the paraphrase. Stop saying that. That's dumb. Be responsible for your own behavior.
Exactly. And then the book of Job totally pushes back on the idea that somehow what has happened to us was deserved.
Right.
That it's the just punishment for what happened, for what we did. Right. So there's other voices in the Hebrew Bible that say, I don't think so.
And so it helps to keep that in mind as we go through this particular.
And this is important even in this story, because that doesn't really fit on the David story. If you think of the David story, here is David who is doing all kinds of things wrong, and he's not cut off from God. Yes, there are some consequences for some of his behaviors, but God does not desert him. He, and you know, in fact, he's, even with all the stories and all the commandments that he breaks, God is still there with him and for him. And this is a merciful God and a God of grace and a God who lives for love. And so even within these stories, you've got the Deuteronomistic kind of approach. If you're getting bad stuff in your life, you must have done bad. But you're also getting this God who is faithful to us, even when we fall to the very bottom of our embracing evil or desire or whatever inordinately. So it's there too. These themes are there running side by side. And you know, always, and we probably said this before, we always have to ask, what is it about you that chose this theological perspective rather than this one?
When they're judgmental, both angry God.
Right. Well, it's the same with like the creation stories back in Genesis. Why did you choose the second one as being normative for the relationship between men and women instead of the first one, where we are both representative of the image of God?
Our uses of the Bible often say more about us than they say about the Bible. So that's why scholarship is really important, because it helps us get out of that loop. By the way, also, as Christian readers of a Bible that has two testaments, we say Jesus rejected the idea that what happens to you is a judgment, right? In Luke's gospel and in John's gospel, that comes up and Jesus says, nope, don't think so, right? So, in other words, it's really important to see the Bible as sometimes a conversation, sometimes an argument around a seminar table, and not to simply get fixated on whatever simple answer helps you feel good about you and feel righteous about your enemies, right? So it's pretty important. And so the Deuteronomists, I'll say the Deuteronomists, Their theology is overlaid more on Kings than on Samuel, but it's there. It's through it all, because they're the ones who were helping kind of collect the prophets, that is the narrative books, starting with Joshua. They're the ones who are pulling that stuff all together during the exile. But it's really important to see it as an overlay. And every once in a while in the text, you'll see a peekaboo of other traditions which say, nah, there's another way to look at this. Right. So one more thing in terms of explaining. The Hebrew Bible has a number of covenant traditions, right? God makes a covenant with Abraham and Sarai. It's an unconditional covenant. You know, you just trust me. I'm going to make sure you have land and progeny, and that you're those who descend from you will be a blessing to the nations, right?
And there'll be a lot of them.
Right. And then there's the Mosaic covenant, which is more of a conditional covenant. Based on Hittite covenant treaties, I, Yahweh, your God, got you out of Egypt, and I'm going to bring you to a good land, and here's what I expect from you. And the Mosaic covenant is rendered differently in Exodus and then in Deuteronomy, but in both cases, it's kind of a conditional covenant. Now, in 2 Samuel 7, there's a new covenant, God's covenant with David, God's pact, God's treaty, God's deal with David, where God says to David through Nathan, I'm going to make a dynasty out of you. And if your children who serve as kings after you mess up, there'll be consequences, but I will never take my steadfast love from your house. There will always be a Davidic monarch. That's the unconditional nature of the Davidic covenant. That's articulated in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel. And one of the stories we're going to focus on here shortly, the David and Bathsheba story, put the covenant to the test. That covenant, though, turns out to have some disastrous moral consequences down the road as Judean monarchs think, hey, we're good. We're just good. And then they continue to perpetuate injustice in the land. But that's a story for another podcast on the prophets. So,
well, and some of that, the promises, the implications or chosen implications of that promise are still at work in the world today, as far as the land of Israel and Palestine, and what was it that God promised to whom, when. So it still has reverberations today. So we're going into the explore part, and we'll be starting to look at some of the specific stories. And Kieran, I'm glad you've been doing this wide reading, as painful as it's been for you, through Samuels and Kings. And, you know, we're really looking forward to some of the insights that you have and the questions, but also bringing to the surface some of the stories that are there that, you know, make us raise our eyebrows and go, what? So, but before we do that, I just wanted to give us the reminder about what our goal is in these Hebrew sessions. And our job here is not to put makeup on the stories and give them an acceptable appearance. That's definitely not one of the things we're trying to do. Our goal here is first to understand the time that these things were written, the dynamics, and the relationships. And I think that's one that we maybe haven't noted as much, but that's really what we're looking at quite often is, what about these relationships, especially relationships with God? So our goal here is, it's not to judge the scripture using our own time, which is so enlightened, of course, as the primary way of determining its value. And it's not to defend it, like, oh my goodness, it's scripture, it must be right, or to twist it into a happy story in some way. That we're not, those aren't our goals. But it's also not to toss it, to just say, oh, this is unacceptable for us today, and so we're going to just out the window with this. So we want to say, let's dig in. Let's take a look at these human beings who are trying to write about their experience with God, their understanding of God, the things that have been passed on to them about God. These are human writers using the language and the culture of their time, mm-hmm. to try and pass on these glimpses of God or God encounters that they've had. And they only have their time and language to work with. And they only have the way of being that they can see and know, and it's been passed on to them. Yes, little changes happen over time, but they're not going to think like we do. They couldn't. There's no way that they can. And so we will see, as we're reading these things, blind spots, you know, that these writers had. We're going to be looking at a culture where women are being passed around as kind of like a monetary object, or as flesh, you know, being used to gain power for a man, for one man to another man, all those kinds of things. But that's the reality of that time. And rather than just saying, oh my gosh, that's awful, let's see what else they know besides the culture that they're a part of. So that's what we're going to be kind of trying to look in and saying, you know, we have to check our desire to either judge these people in their time, or to skip over the ugly parts of the stories, because sometimes it's the ugly parts where we really get to begin to see what is the nature of God in this story. So scriptures are really not so much about the people or their cultures. It's what they're trying to point to about what is the nature of this God. And there's some pieces that they're going to say that we're going to say, it doesn't sound like my God. And that's certainly something we need to be able to say, is that there's some elements of their understandings of God that, especially if we're using the Jesus lens to help us determine who God is, that we can just say, nope, that doesn't fit. And we need to be okay with saying there's some ideas in the Old Testament, my goodness, so much a product of their time, they just aren't translatable. But there may be some that are. So we shouldn't be surprised if we actually find some things that they're saying that may speak to us. And so that's our approach, is let's listen to people's stories about what they think about God. Let's see if some of them fit for us, and if there's some things to dig out of their understandings that still have power and relevance for us.
We're going to hear them out before we either dismiss or simply gloss over.
Right. Okay. Or accept wholeheartedly as though this is exactly how we should all be today, which right. There are people who do that. And so we're not.
Yes, they do. But again, read 2 Samuel, because that is not happening. So.
Well, it's really important for us to pay attention to the details in these stories, because if we don't, our own lenses and biases and presuppositions will get quickly overlaid on the story, and we'll think we're reading the story when in fact we're just reading ourselves. So when we get to this David and Bathsheba and Nathan story, it's almost like a drama in three acts in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. And so this story is just really, oh my gosh, it's so disturbing and so gut-wrenching to read what's happening here, especially if you pay attention to the details in the text.
Right. And I'm afraid that these are stories that have been glossed over so much that it's almost like people have taken the children's Bible version of it and just let that stand as good enough understanding of what's really happening here. We need to take it more seriously than that. So yeah. Do you want to tell us about what's in these chapters?
I'll start and we'll just go back and forth.
Okay.
So here's the scene. David's kingdom is well established. This covenant has been made. David's feeling really good. His men are out fighting somewhere on the front. He's taking a nap in the afternoon. It's springtime. And lo and behold, he looks out and sees on the rooftop of a neighboring house the woman Bathsheba, and she's bathing. The text is very explicit. She's bathing. This is a purification rite after her period. And she's very, very pretty. And oh, by the way, her husband, Uriah the Hittite, is one of David's elite soldiers, a group called the 30. And he's out at the front. Notice the name, Uriah the Hittite. It's a bit peculiar because Uriah is a true Hebrew name. I mean, something like Yahweh is my light. But he's always called the Hittite. And so let's think of him as a resident alien. Because that will help us understand the levels of injustice in this story. He's a resident alien fighting for David. He's married to an Israelite woman named Bathsheba. He's out doing his duty at the front. Bathsheba's doing her duty as it was understood in priestly circles in terms of this purification. David sees her and David wants her.
So there's one piece here that I want to throw in, because it's one that is often twisted to say that somehow Bathsheba was seducing David. Mm-hmm. Because there's this really bad tendency within Christianity, especially to, you know, blame women, whether it's a snake or whether, you know, all kinds of things to blame women and for the sexual desire of men. And to put it on women. And so it's really important to understand that bathing on the rooftop was not an unusual thing. this is a normal thing to do, especially in the afternoon when the heat gets very, very built up in the homes. And so if you're going to do anything, you're going to probably do it on the rooftops. And so this was, you know, this was not a culture in which any form of nudity was suggestive or provocative. And I think that's really essential to understand that Bathsheba is not doing anything that would have drawn attention normally.
So David has people check out, see whether there's any guys in the house over there, right? Because then she will be alone.
Because he doesn't know who she is yet.
Right. So.
So he asks, well, who is she? Yes. Yeah,
and she's this and she's Bathsheba. And you know, so David sends people and the text says they went and got her. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't tell you. I see this in commentaries all the time that describe what happens as an affair. No, there's not consent involved here. People from the Davidic monarch, the king, went and got her. The text says, and she came. Well, she had no choice.
Right.
Right there. So in other words, you really have to see there are elements of coercion all through this story. Monarch, woman, male, woman. Patriarchal culture, woman way down low. And so this story needs to, what happens next, it needs to be seen as a rape.
So I think it's important to really make it clear what the text says. He didn't summon her and she responded to his summons. He sent people to get forcibly her. Bring her to him.
They went to get her. That's what the text says. And in this part of the story,
she says, so David sent messengers to get her and she came to him and he lay with her.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Sorry. But you can
not even dinner first. I mean, there's just that's just appalling. No, I mean, I make light because it's just awful. And you have to kind of process that because it's not the way the story is told or even understood generally.
And this is one of the places where we want to fancy this up for today and make David fit our appropriateness standards. But this probably was not unusual at all in his day, that this kind of
it's
sense.
Not unusual in this day.
Good point. Mm-hmm. In the sense of entitlement, because he's a man. And, you know, in this culture, as in many cultures today, women don't get to make choices. They don't get to say no. I mean, there's still a lot of cultures in our world where women don't get to say no and have it heard as anything at all. So this is a reality. We need to let this text describe to us the culture of that time and place.
And need to be very aware of all of the digital recordings. I wanted to say tapes. That's old language. All the digital recordings that are playing in especially white males' heads when they read this story. And all kinds of assumptions that are made that the text does not bear out. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you read this in the larger narrative of Samuel, there's an earlier story about one of David's wives named Michal, who is the youngest daughter of Saul. Michal is passed around as if she's a tradable commodity.
This is one of the things that Karen had questions about as we were
looking we're gonna talk about Michal a little bit as we get to my question part because that's that helps for me at least, and I think it will help our listeners kind of see this in its bigger context than just David and Bathsheba.
I think that's really important. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's fine.
I just wanted to make sure we got that piece. Started.
This is a class, and we're just going back and forth. Okay. So then the story goes from bad to worse. Mm-hmm. Right. So in this part of the narrative, the only thing Bathsheba says is, I'm pregnant.
And this is in 2 Samuel, the only actual thing we hear her say.
Right. So her husband, Uriah, the resident alien, with or without a green card, not sure. He's a resident alien with a Hebrew name. He's out fighting for David on the front lines. And when Bathsheba is pregnant because of David, David now goes into cover-up mode, mm-hmm. right? And so as we tell our students when we're working through the story, there is no 1-800 who's the father in this time and place. You can't do a DNA test, right? So David sends a message to the front lines for a special meeting with Uriah. Very unusual to pull somebody off the front lines. Come back to the king. And David basically tries to get Uriah to go yeah. home and sleep with Bathsheba.
To have sex with his wife.
Right. David says, uses the euphemism, go home, wash your feet, which is a euphemism in the Hebrew Bible for the feet are often the genitals. Go home and have sex. And Uriah, the resident alien, is being faithful to his vow, his military vow, to not have sex as long as he's in combat. He refuses to do that. He sleeps outside, I think.
Sleeps, right? Yeah.
Where outside the door, I think, is where he sleeps.
And where the yeah. servants are. So everybody knows. And there is also this possibility that he senses that there's trickery about, and he doesn't want to be tricked into being unfaithful to his vow. So it may be that he's just a really honest person, but it may also be that he's like, wait a minute.
Are you testing my commitment to what I've agreed to do?
Exactly.
So it's really important here at this point in the story, Bathsheba, who has been coerced and raped, she's depicted as faithful to what she knows of the Mosaic covenant. She's doing this ritual bath. Uriah, the resident alien, either with or without a green card, we don't know. He's come back from the front, and he's being faithful to his vows. They are more faithful to Yahweh than David is. And David's like, I got to do something else. This isn't working.
Because he can't get Uriah to cover his mistake by having sex with his wife. And then we can say, yep, this was his baby. So Uriah's not cooperating. So David, I would say desperate. Desperation creates all kinds of blindness. He's like, I've got to get rid of Uriah because he's going to know. And now all the servants in his household are going to know because they know he didn't have sex with his wife. So he works it out that he sends a message with Uriah back to the front to give to the commander, which is basically, it's a sealed one. So he doesn't know what it says, but it basically is his death. the plan for his death, which basically David says, yeah, you guys go into battle and then I'll pull back but don't let Uriah know and basically set him up to be killed in battle.
Yeah. Send him to the front.
Right. Send him to the front with his death warrant in his hand. And that's what happens.
Death warrant.
Right?
That's the word I was looking for. Good. Thank you.
So then the word comes back that Uriah was killed. And David's like, the sword takes one and now another, you know, it just happens, you know, though he's responsible now for the murder, for setting up the murder. Right. And
And he's also committed adultery. And he is also coveted his neighbor's wife. Well, let's see. So he's at least on three commandments.
Born false witness. So that's he's on four.
Lying as well.
Yeah, he's working on all the Big Ten here, basically. And and I don't mean football or basketball, right? So,
but it's multiple layers of his behavior. It's not just one thing. We're talking. Multiple things.
Exactly. And I think this is another thing we can identify with in our time. And I might be jumping ahead a little bit here, but it's this sense that somehow this is a patriarchy issue, mm-hmm. that men in power must worry more about their appearance, how they're seen, than about reality. And David is desperate for this to not be seen. For what it is.
Yeah.
And that's true today. I mean, we see it all.
Oh, yeah.
Especially men of privilege doing whatever they think is necessary to keep their the image of them the way they want it to be.
And that men always just get what they want, right?
Well, and that it's okay if other people suffer in order for them to keep that vision in front of people.
And so notice when we pay attention to these really like difficult details of the text, how the text is now becoming a mirror, a magnifying glass, because we can begin to see our social, gender, sexual realities through the text too.
And so the whole Me Too movement is, this is the kind of situations in which the necessity to speak is as real now as it was in this time.
So David takes Bathsheba into his harem, right? And it's so cool. I love this line at the end of chapter 11. The narrator of the story says, "But the thing that David did displeased Yahweh." Right? It's just like, so this is a place where the commentary on the text that's in the text is reminding the reader, this was really messed up.
Mm-hmm.
This was really messed up.
And that God isn't condoning this kind of behavior. Right.
So then the next, this is the, I guess we'll call it the third scene in the play, is the prophet Nathan. And, you know, in our next two podcasts, we'll deal with prophets explicitly, but Nathan is a prophet. The word prophet in Hebrew is Navi, and it means somebody who's been called, who has a divine call. And many prophets in the Hebrew Bible are connected to kings. They're like the king's counselors and something like that, which led to constant abuse, because the prophet could say, "Oh, king, whatever you do is what Yahweh wants. You're so wonderful." You know, it's a
yes man kind of thing.
Nathan is not that kind of prophet. So then Nathan comes into David and says, "I got a little story to tell you, David."
Yes, this gets really interesting here with the mirror in front of David. Let's talk about Nathan's response to David. Before you tell the story, my question from what we just talked about, when you talked about David not wanting this to come out, to cover it, and it's not so much the fear of what his colleagues will think of him, but it's what Nathan and what Nathan represents, knowing this about him.
And what the people, especially faithful people, faithful to God, will have to see.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the
story. Well, and here's one of the tricky parts about the monarchy in as it's developing, is that it's not just seen as a political necessity. There's the implication that somehow God is, God may have anointed them, but also that they speak for God in some ways, or they represent God in some ways. And that makes this all very tricky, especially David's not wanting faithful people to see who he really is.
So Nathan does the very prophetic job of calling out the king. And this is in the ancient Near East, all kinds of monarchies had prophet figures, sage figures attached to their courts, who were primarily yes men and sometimes yes women, who were there to give the divine assurance, the assurance from the gods that whatever the monarch was doing was right. And Nathan is not going to do that. Nathan tells the story in which David condemns himself. And so
not knowingly.
Not knowing. David.
I'll go ahead and read it.
Yeah, this is
it. This is
so
the
cool.
Beginning
I love
of,
this.
Of chapter 12 in 2 Samuel. So there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared that for the guest who had come to him. So this is the story that Nathan told David. David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And then Nathan says to David, you are the man.
Ouch.
Yeah. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your bosom and gave. And he's saying, if you wanted something, ask for it. But to simply take this that does not belong to you, and you can interpret that in a lot of ways. Whether the taking of Bathsheba or the taking of sex from Bathsheba, that this is not okay. This is not acceptable. So, and then there's some kind of curses on David because of this.
This is a story, not just a drama, it's a trauma.
Yes.
Right. And the trauma is Bathsheba's.
Yes. Because what happens later, one of the consequences of David's action is that the child that Bathsheba bears will, after it's born, will die. Mm-hmm. But again, you recognize these are books written by men. And you start adding up here, what is the trauma of Bathsheba? So there is the trauma of being taken from the safety of her own home and being raped by the king. And, you know, there's so much to go into here, but I think probably, well, maybe not all of us, but many of us have heard women who have been raped who after the fact say, well, I don't know if it was really a rape because, you know, I kind of, you know, it kind of made.
I'd been drinking and I don't know what I said.
Or I felt, you know, his attention made me feel special. And so, you know, and that insecurity that so many of us women have, that we aren't lovable, that we're not worthwhile, and that our worth is tied up in the attentions of a man. I mean, that's all going on here. And so, but, you know, her consent doesn't matter here, ultimately. And so to say that this is rape, I think, is very appropriate. That's one trauma. The next is letting David know and acknowledging to herself that she's pregnant. And then there is the death of her husband. We don't really know whether she ever knew how or why he died. That's not really clear. But she's in this mess, and her husband dies. And then she's taken into David's harem, which he might think is like a really good thing for her. But her freedoms have been constrained considerably. And then it's her child that dies because of David's action. So there's these ongoing traumas throughout. And I think we don't think about that nearly enough to recognize the injustice of all of that. And so Nathan's comeuppance to David about how God sees this as an act of violence, as an act of stealing the poor man's lamb that he loves. It is very powerful, I think, but it's only the depth of it is only recognizable if we acknowledge the trauma that Bathsheba has experienced on all these different levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Simply because she's a woman. All of these things that make her vulnerable are because she's a woman.
And this will not be the last story of a woman traumatized by males in the narrative of Samuel and Kings. So and that's just really here. If there's good news in this story,
we're looking.
If there's good news in the story, it's this, that the editors of Samuel didn't scrub the story.
Scrub it out. Clean.
Right.
Or either take it out now, or try to put a nice face on it.
What's interesting is that the book we call First and Second Chronicles which is a later book. It's from the post-exilic period. It's from, you know, 400-ish down to 300-ish.
But it's still describing the same time period.
It uses Samuel and Kings as sources for its narrative, and it scrubs the story out because Chronicles is very pro-David. And so think of Chronicles as the news outlet that makes David always look good, right? And
there's
so
news outlets like that. That some people just
saying.
Good.
And so we can at least be grateful to the Deuteronomistic editors. It's part of their plan too. They want to show that the monarchy was a bad idea, but they do not scrub the story, even though they also keep that part of the story which says God made a covenant with David. And by the way, God stands by the covenant here. God says, here's the consequences, but there's still going to be a Davidic monarchy after this. So it's a little glimmer of what we will come to call God's unconditional love for us. But also have to be very careful and remember that the editors of the story think that the baby died because it was divine punishment on David. That whole perspective is criticized by other books of the Hebrew Bible. So we just have to be careful not to say, see, everything that happens is a divine judgment. Mm-hmm. It's the narrator's overlay on the story.
But we shouldn't lose track of the fact that God sees David's actions as injustice.
Well, I think there's also some hints about God's unconditional love, because just as when we talk about Michal in a little while, even here, the poor man loved the ewe. The poor man, it was beloved as a daughter. So the writer is making the hearer of the scripture aware that there is this kind of beloved essence,
yes,
nature in the story.
That's affirmed.
Yeah. That's compared to David's behavior, and which casts David's behavior in shadow.
Yes, yes. And that there is mutual love that is happening in this time, even though there is also love of power that then abuses people. So, yeah, I that's a really important one. And the Michal story has that as well.
So do you want to go there, or do you want to do, or do you want to help us experience this text in a positive light? Or do you want me to get my venting out first? Because I have several.
I mean, I hope we can do both, but I know that we're getting kind of long here, but we would love to hear your questions and see if we can. And then the experience part will be some questions for people to take with them to journal with. So that will be, we can just offer those at the end for people to think about in their own time. But yeah, I'd love to for us to explore some of your questions, because we may not have answers, but they do. They'll no doubt shed light.
So my questions come from the broader reading of 2 Samuel. So I had read 1 Samuel for our last podcast, so I had read ahead, but this time I read 2 Samuel just beginning to end. And a lot of things kind of came up. And some of them, I think, speak to where we've just gone with this. So in this particular narrative of David, Bathsheba gets all the attention. That's who has been lifted out of 2 Samuel as the story that illustrates a lot of different things. You can Google it and find all kinds of stuff out there that's not helpful about
sure.
But what's hidden in there are some other stories.
Yes.
And is it Michal? Is that how we're going to pronounce her name? Michal. It looks like Michael.
Yeah, it's Michal in Hebrew.
Okay. So Michal was one of David's first wives, as I read the story, given to him by Saul.
Mm-hmm. One of Saul's daughters.
Of Saul's daughter. So again, it's the political alliances that are being made at different times. And when Saul got totally ticked off at David for some other behaviors, as Saul went into his Macbeth kind of period, then we have him taking Michal back and giving her to someone else.
Yes.
And his name, if I look at it correctly, is Paltiel.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Paltiel. Yeah. which when you begin to follow that storyline of Michal and then this experience of being given back, given to somebody else, later in the story, when David is reconciling with Saul's heirs, one of the conditions he makes to reconcile is he wants her back. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, both the most horrendous and saddest thing I've ever read in the Old Testament. And I've read all about Joshua killing all the people, taking the booty and going home. And this is sadder because of how it's written.
Mm-hmm. It's so intentional.
He says, David sent a messenger, give me my wife, Michal, to whom I became engaged at the price of 100 foreskins, gentlemen. So be happy about that.
Yes.
100 foreskins of the Philistines. And I'm not even going to pronounce his name. And so he took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish, but her husband went with her, weeping as he walked behind her all the way.
Yep.
And then Abner said to him, go back home, exclamation mark. And so he went back. Oh, that's just so sad. And so my question isn't so much why is that happening and so sad, but why was it included?
That's the perfect question.
It is a good question.
And because it helps us to see some of the things that the author or authors want to raise up. They want us to see how cruel this act was, how there isn't consensus. There isn't any consideration of other people. But also, again, it points to there being a kind of mutuality. There is possible to have mutual love and to have, you know, this heartbroken man who is, you know, pitifully following along and hoping that things will change and finally being told they're not. You might as well go home. Yeah, I think that's really important. It's doing one other thing as well. And this that whole argument about the monarchy, about was it a good thing or a bad thing? Right from the beginning, one of the arguments is, if you get a king, here's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to take your daughters to put into his harem or to serve him in his, you know, abodes. And he's going to take your son to wars and have them killed.
That was the warning.
Yep. Yeah. And so this is that part of that argument still going on. Look, what we warned of is happening right here in front of us. I don't know if you read what happens later with Michal.
So that's the next part of this.
Good.
Is something happens later that we read, that we hear about as we're learning about the Bible growing up. Mm-hmm. We learn about David returning the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and he dances before it in his loincloth, and his wife, clueless, if you just accept how you're taught this, his clueless wife, who obviously didn't understand the importance of this event and didn't understand that David was dancing around naked because he was worshiping God, she chastises him for it. Well, that's how it's kind of tossed out there.
And if you don't know the backstory,
until you realize that's Michal, and she has every right to think he's a Looney Tune and be totally ticked off at him, because this is what happened to her.
Exactly. And she is disgusted with him for basically exposing himself in this dance of ecstasy. But she says, you know, you had no consideration for all the women who were there that you just exposed yourselves to. And he said, oh, they loved it. Right?
She calls him like any vulgar fellow.
Yes. And he says, oh, those handmaidens think I'm amazing. And so, yes. And so, yeah. And if we know the backstory, then we can start to see, because in the very beginning, she loved him. Right. She loved him. She wanted to be with him. And now she has seen all these other sides of him, so to speak. And she's disgusted. And if you... And you, I'm sure you have, you read what happens right after that, after she
so
corrects him.
it's not just Michal, though.
No.
It's not just Bathsheba and Michal. Then we have Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to Tamar in 2 Samuel? So there's not just rape, but it's incestual rape by David's son on his half-sister, Tamar, and David's behavior towards that. He's the one that commands her to go to his son. And then he forgives his son. I'm paraphrasing what I read, but because he loved him.
Yeah.
And it's...
what does that say about how he felt towards his daughter, right?
Or just in general about how we cover up other people's behavior and don't hold people accountable to behavior. So we have Michal, we have Bathsheba, we have Tamar. And then towards the end of the story, we have David fleeing as army comes in. And he takes all his primary wives, his first tier wives with him. But he leaves behind what's called the secondary wives, and the leader of the incoming army enters the harem and basically is allowed to have sex with the secondary wives. So this just layer after layer of this kind of behavior, which really mirrors David's behavior.
And
if we're looking at what it is.
And is behavior that is commonplace and accepted. I won't say acceptable, but accepted. In that.
So when we read this, we don't want to take, as you said, our own lens as women and hopefully strong feminist women and just go, screw it, I'm not going to read 2 Samuel. We don't want to do that. And we want to try to have some value in the content. But when we read through all that, it's pretty hard by the time you're at the end of it, it's kind of like, ugh, I don't know how much more of this I can take.
Yeah. So I think that's a totally necessary reaction to the text. And there's so many ways that the text is trying to show up the monarchy and monarchical power and male power and male privilege for what they are. The text does that. And we have to pay attention to that as readers, that the text is actually a Rorschach test on our own. It can be a Rorschach test on our own gender inequalities. And that's one place where the text can be helpful to us. It's like, oh, too bad. You know, I wish we could say, well, this is just the Iron Age. Oh, no, this is the 21st century. This is us. This is the United States. This is places like the Congo where women are constantly used as, you know, they're raped as a way of diminishing them and others.
And demoralizing their whole.
Right. So this kind of stuff is constantly going on.
And this is a piece that I was going to say earlier, but I think it fits here, too. And I said that all cultures have blind spots, right? We can't imagine where we haven't been yet. So we can't always see what the injustices are that are just built into our systems. And so we can look back and we can see the blind spots that are here, but we can also see that some of the authors are trying to help people see these as blind spots too.
And had warned us about them through Nathan and his
exactly. So there's that starting to help people imagine there's another way. There's another way of being, of respecting each other, of living. But I wanted to kind of just draw that back to us and what are our blind spots. We have them too. We live in a culture where we've accepted how things are as how things are. Mm-hmm. And until things start to open our eyes to see that they could be another way, that's when we start to say, oh my gosh, what have we been doing? And I think this is a moment when that's happening with George Floyd, with the pandemic and seeing all of the inequities. I mean, there's some people, many people of color, but you know, some white people too, who have been saying, oh my goodness, this is terrible, this system that we're in, and we're all part of this systemic racism and systemic sexism. Well, you know, a big portion of the population didn't see that clearly until this last year. We're getting insights that help us to see what our blind spots have been. And so this is a long, slow process. And it's a long, slow process for the people who we're reading about, as it is for us, of slowly being able to see where change is necessary and needed, and asking God to help us change our hearts and minds so that these changes can become reality, which at this moment, we have more of a likelihood of some of these changes becoming reality than we did a year ago,
right,
when so many of us could not see clearly these blind spots that we've lived in and many of us benefited from for a very long time.
Yeah. And the church that uses these texts as canon has to decide, are we going to take the risk to be the Nathans? Mm-hmm. And call out sexism, call out racism, call out environmental degradation, call out the abuse of people. I mean, there's so many things. And mm-hmm. or are we going to be just, you know, part of David's 30, part of his court, part of his chosen people who are like, things are good for us, so they must be good for everybody. And, you know, so we have a choice to make, too. And the text puts right. that choice before us as readers.
And just going back to Michal and to Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. In this story, in their stories, to some degree, to this degree that they are able, they go from being acted upon to acting themselves and changing the directions of what will be. Michal, she speaks her mind and she is disgusted with David. And yes, it's the text says, so he won't have sex with her because he doesn't want to have offspring by her.
Well, that's a big punishment on her perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
She's like, woohoo, I'm free.
So depending on how she felt about all of that, yes, she might have been relieved. But she did what she could do. She was honest to herself. Bathsheba, later in the story, this is in 1 Kings 1, chapters 1 and 2, where with, again, Nathan's help. So read here, God's help. She's able to save herself and Solomon, her son, young son at this point, and put the monarchy back on track to with a king who loves God. And so she goes to David. He's near the very end of his life. And she says, did you know that your son, what's his name?
Adonijah, sorry.
Adonijah, there it is. That he's just proclaimed himself king and is having a party and has all of David's army leaders and everybody on his side. He's off here having a party about this. David doesn't know. And so Nathan and Bathsheba reveal this to him and said, what about your promise? Mm-hmm. That Solomon would be the next king. Did you know what it is? What's his name again?
Adonijah
is doing. And David is sparked into action. His conscience is pricked, some might in other places. And he remembers his promise to God, his promise to Bathsheba about Solomon. And gets right on it, and you know, and Solomon is anointed and made king, and the vast majority of the people recognize that. So Bathsheba's willingness to speak on behalf of herself and Solomon and the promises that David had made, she is now one who is acting, mm-hmm. Instead of just being acted upon. So I think that's another thing to take from these storylines.
And even within the severe constraints that are on a Michal or on Bathsheba, I think certainly a feminist lens and a liberation lens would look at these texts and say, these stories, even within constraints, we have to say the whatever no we can say to the powers that be, we have to say it, right? Mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't seem to get us anything, the no to David or the no to whatever, right, that is oppressing, abusive, abusing, discarding people, whatever no we can say, There's a moral prophetic obligation to say it, regardless of what it gets. Right? I think that's a really important,
that there's
important
a
theme in the story.
Cumulative change that happens.
Well, it's not the last that we hear from Bathsheba or Tamar, for that matter, because when we get to Matthew, they appear again.
As people that God used in very, as important people in the storyline of Israel.
It's like that genealogy in Matthew's gospel that includes them. It's like,
exactly.
It's like Matthew saying, hey, don't forget, they weren't just, you might have thought they were minor characters. No, they're part of a larger divine drama. So right. I'm glad you brought that up, Karen. That's really an important. Yeah.
They come back again for us. So all the more reason to pay attention to them here in second.
Their involvement in the story makes a difference.
I do have one last comment on this, and it was just something I noticed at the end of 2 Samuel. I call it feminine redemption. After all this crap that happens to all these women through 2 Samuel, at the very end, he goes and finds some wise women. What? Where did they come from? Who were they? In the commentaries, it says, oh, they could have been like left over from the tribal period. Nobody told them that they weren't important anymore. What's the deal? Are they like the crones, the herbal healers? Who are these wise women?
Probably they're in the style of Deborah, who was the judge, who was a judge. She was a military leader. She was a prophet of sorts. And she was, you know, the early people came to her for advice as well as for counsel. And so I think it's probably that kind of that sense of that within the culture. There are these women who are recognized for these kinds of gifts of God, not just to them, but to the whole community.
Women prophets occasionally show up here in the narrative of Samuel and Kings. So it sounds like they're their own kind of prophetic guild.
Yeah.
Right. So, and they may be keeping alive anti-monarchy traditions in their own way. So it'd be interesting to pursue that with a number of feminist commentators on the text, just to see where they would go with that. But
right.
Yeah, so
I just found it interesting at the end of all this trauma for women that we kind of conclude the women's perspective in the story with these wise women. I think that's an interesting editorial literary device, if you will.
Exactly. Again, Samuel. Why was this included?
Exactly. Okay, those are all of my observations, questions, and venting that I had to do after reading about this.
Oh, these texts.
It's gut-wrenching.
These texts, if we go there and if we're willing to take them seriously, they're going to touch us. They're going to trigger us, too. And they're going to challenge us to not flinch away. And I think that's scripture should do that for us.
Absolutely.
So we're going to go into the experience part. And if you haven't got something to write with, go get something to write with and give you a little time to journal on a few questions. So again, I just want to start where we start with how we're approaching scripture. So in this part, in the experience part, it's to consider how the people in the story see and experience God in their lives. And if you can find something in their story that fits or enhances your walk with Christ or understanding of God, great. But if nothing fits, that's okay too. Scripture is here as a servant to our faith, not as a dictator of faith. And so if it's helpful, use it. If it gets in the way, go on to something else. Go on to another aspect of faith building. So I'll take a little time to journal about the following questions. And I'd ask you to do this prayerfully because our times of harm and hurt are sometimes hard to spend time with. And so to be wise in that. But the question is, can you identify with Bathsheba as you remember times when choice was taken away from you or where powers that you didn't have any control over hurt you or threw your life into chaos. And then to take time too, to think how and where did healing and hope happen? And to make room for the realizations of those people or times or the presence of the spirit or another person reminding you of God's love. However it might happen, and maybe you're still in that process of trying to find healing and hope, and acknowledge that as well. Even the longing for that is part of the process. So the next, and this is the part I was just telling you about in 1 Kings, where Bathsheba's speech to David opens his eyes in a way. And, you know, God, through Nathan, shone a light on the evil acts of David toward Bathsheba and Uriah. And then later, the end of David's life, Nathan comes and warns Bathsheba that she and Solomon are in danger and asks her to help him keep Adonijah from becoming the next king. And together they convince David to act. And it's Bathsheba's speech to David that stirs him to remembrance and to action. And so in some very real ways, she becomes God's voice to David, reminding him of his own integrity or whatever is left of his integrity. And so I want you to consider for yourself, when has God helped you speak or act for justice? Or how or through whom has God given you the courage or the words to make a new path in your own life? As we think of Bathsheba, of Michal. So take a bit of time with these questions and see what it might reveal about what you know about God, about your story with God.
Thank you, Charmaine. We are coming to the close of what ended up being a rather long episode about David, Nathan, and Bathsheba. But I do want to give you the opportunity, if there's any last thoughts or comments that have come to you before we close out, or maybe tell us where we're going in our next episode.
I think I would say that any action towards liberative justice, however small, matters. That's something I learned from these texts.
And in the digging in and the going through all of those feelings, the question for me became, how do we get a changed and better world? And you know, how do we get there? And I think in this story, you know, Nathan's words, brave, courageous actions by people, it's one step at a time. You know, change happens one step at a time as we realize, as our eyes are opened, as our hearts are broken. It's one realization at a time, one mistake at a time, one apology at a time, one epiphany at a time, one little success at a time. And that's how we move forward towards God's imagined world.
For next time, we will be considering the prophet known as Isaiah of Jerusalem, who's got a book named after him, but he's not the only author writing in that book. It's like a big conglomeration of many of words from several prophets, but we'll focus on Isaiah of Jerusalem.
Which is basically the chapters.
Isaiah of Jerusalem's oracles and roughly chapters 1 through 39, with some exceptions, right?
Always exceptions, absolutely.
A whole lot of editing going on in that book.
Yeah, so. And you don't have to read all 39 chapters, but.
Oh, thank you.
Also, just a reminder that Font's writings on many of these things are pretty concise, and he gives a really nice background. So if you're using that text, take a quick look before you start reading. He'll give you some sense of the landscape.
Excellent.
Reading Isaiah will help us deal with the question, a good community of Christ question. So what does it mean to be a prophetic people?
Oh, this is good. I'm looking forward to that. Not to reading the 39 chapters, but definitely to the discussion. So before we close out, I think this was episode 6 of Hebrew. So we're just rolling along here. Before we close that out, I want to give a shout out to my friend, Reverend Rock Fremont. He's a UCC pastor down in Arizona, who, when I told him what we were recording, he called my attention to an article out of Christian Century. So listeners, if you're not familiar with Christian Century, it's a periodical of which you might want to be familiar. So I would encourage you to Google that and look it up. But there was an article by Anna Carter Florence titled, "Read the Rape of Tamar and Pay Attention to the Verbs." And in light of the closing thoughts that Tony and Charmaine just gave us, I'd say that will be a really wonderful, painful and wonderful read to help continue to make sense of some of the things that we encounter when we read scripture. So between now and then, thank you, Tony and Charmaine Shavala-Smith, for guiding us through Hebrew scripture, what we call the Old Testament. I'm Karen Peter. This is Project Zion. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.